Q-O-I, and it was used to communicate with God. In fact, Native Americans, which I have a great interest in, use crystals for spirit communication. And it's an interesting thing, and if we get some time, I'll tell you how you can do a few things with it that are sort of magical.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I want to take some crystals with me on my ghost hunt.
You need to do that, and I'll tell you how to make some lights out of them and maybe get some communication.
That sounds awesome.
It's pretty easy to do.
So, but he did talk about this crystal, which, of course, hasn't been found. But then again, I read every now and then in news articles and things like that. These are just normal articles, people studying things and of different properties of crystals that they can now take advantage of, even in like the silicon in computer chips and stuff. That's
right.
All the same stuff.
Well, and actually, you know, a quartz crystal is what makes quartz watches work so well.
Right.
And by squeezing a quartz crystal, electricity is produced. It's called the piezoelectric effect in physics. It's a very well-established effect. We know that there is such a thing as earth lights, which physicists refer to as plasmas. Ball lightning is related to it, and all of those things result from, seismic stress that either crushes or puts pressure on crystalline stones, and electricity is produced. It's kind of complicated, but it's actually pretty easy to understand. And Casey did talk about those things using his own terminology. But when it comes to this crystal, he did say that they had the ability to focus the energy of the crystal, and they used them in flying machines. And I want to, before I move off of that, I've got to say that when he described the most advanced flying machine that the Atlanteans had, which actually was around 28,000 B.C., according to Casey, 30,000 years ago, the most advanced flying machine they had, he said, was like a blimp or a dirigible, and the actual gas bag itself was made from skins that had been sewn together. Skins of elephants, pachyderms, and other animals, and he said that the crystal was employed to fill these by focusing the light and producing a gas which would then fill these bags, and then they could navigate through light from this crystal. So while that is advanced, it's not the spaceships that people talk about. Now, what's gotten confusing is in a couple of Casey's readings, actually there's three readings where he talks about what looks like extraterrestrials coming to Earth. There are alternative explanations to that, but he does mention it three times, and one of those is one we've gotten real fascinated with. It occurred sometime around 10,500 B.C., and an Atlantean priest got some sort of communication from an extraterrestrial source telling him that Atlantis was about to be destroyed. So they made a plan to preserve their records. They sent three groups out. One group went to Egypt and put a hall of records under the right paw of the Sphinx. The second group went to a temple near Bimini or Andros, and that temple sunk in 10,000 B.C., The third group went to a place called Piedras Negras, Guatemala. And Casey said in his later readings that these halls of records will be found, and they'll probably all be opened around the same time. But the information and the actual plan as to where to put these records came from some sort of an extraterrestrial source. And that's a little disconcerting to me when I first read it. But nevertheless, it's there, and it is what it is.
Right, and... And there is always the possibility of shading in these readings.
What it really looks like, and both Adrian, I don't know if you know who Adrian Gilbert is. He's a very well-known British author. Actually, he was the co-author of the book done by Robert Bouval on the Orion mystery, claiming that the three pyramids of Giza represent the belt of Orion. Well, Gilbert was the co-author in that book, and he's written a number of others, including Signs in the Sky. Gilbert believes, as does Andrew Collins and myself, that this is a sort of mental communication, and actually I think people have had these mental communications for all time.
You mean with extraterrestrials or with other...
Well, Well, with some sort of intelligence that's certainly not earthly or human. That's what I mean.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Well, there's history in that. In the paranormal, there is a massive history about people getting information. It's usually some sort of psychic information, or sometimes it hits them like a beam of light from the sky, or sometimes something comes to them that appears like an angel. And it appears to them repeatedly and gives and delivers a message. And a lot of the information that comes through these sort of experiences is often accurate. It's not always accurate, but it's often accurate, and it usually causes a massive personality disturbance in the individual that gets the information.
So he did indeed describe some kind of event that caused the Atlanteans or the Poseidians.
Atlanteans is fine. They were on the main island was Poseidon.
Okay, so he caused the Atlanteans to say, impending doom. What we're going to have to do is we're going to have to distribute our records. What do you think these records look like, or what do you think they contain?
That's a great question because he really, and I didn't know this until maybe 5 or 6 years ago. It was 6 years ago. He gave a precise and detailed explanation of what these records were. He said there are 32 tablets, and on those tablets is inscribed the history of Atlantis from the time that consciousness, advanced consciousness, that is what we identify as ourselves. He said it entered into the physical realm and came into what previously were basically animals. Our consciousness entered these bodies, and we began to create things on Earth. So Atlantis wrote the history down from that moment until their destruction. And in those 32 tablets is not just this history. It talks about our spiritual nature, and it talks about this crystal and why these crystals work this way. And it actually gives details regarding this Firestone. And in addition to those tablets, he said that there were linens and clothing examples, some weapons, some gold and silver implements, and a variety of everyday tools that the Atlanteans used. And basically, it would be like a time capsule, a modern time capsule that we'd stick in a building, and somebody'd open it 100 years from now. Except Casey decided that it, or the Atlanteans decided they needed to have this thing buried for at least 12,000 years.
And they all remain today, still hidden from us.
Well, they're still hidden, but they're being zeroed in on. At least two of the three are. The one at Bimini, I don't think that will be found anytime soon. That's actually been the major focus, at least the focus that most people are aware of, that the ARE has really paid attention to. But the ARE has played a real integral role in the search at Egypt. But they have to remain in the background there for political considerations.
Although they did mention when they did the opening of the one room, that shaft.
It was like a year and a half ago.
Yeah, they did indeed mention in either that particular episode or that particular program or the one that preceded it about the Great Pyramid itself.
Mm-hmm.
They did mention Casey and the Sphinx and the Hall of Records. So at least, you know, there are people out there who know about it.
One of the head Egyptian archaeologists who's from America, not Sahi Hawass, who's over at all, but Mark Lerner.
Yeah, Mark.
He's a PhD archaeologist who works right under Zahi, and he does most of the actual work there. And Mark Lerner is a major ARE member, I can't give a lot of details here, but he spoke regularly at the ARE. He did a lot of research for the ARE, including carbon dating all the pyramids in Egypt. The ARE sponsored that many years ago.
Well, you raise an interesting idea also by the burial of these tablets, because you just mentioned a minute ago, I heard the term 12,000 years.
Yes.
Okay, now we're saying from today back to then, we're looking at roughly 12,000 years, possibly, or when they were supposed to be discovered, it would have to be around 12,000 years. Am I correct?
Really, 12,500 years, and the actual date of their discovery, Casey never gave, but he gave us a lot of hints, and most of the hints were Sometime after 1998, he also mentioned 2001 in a reading as a critical time.
Okay.
But he never gave an exact date, okay. Nor did he say which one would be discovered first, although it appears the one in Guatemala. Our interpretation and the main people at the ARE, the heads of the ARE, believe Guatemala is probably the one that will be found first, although the Egyptian one would be easier to find.
Is that like for socio-political economic reasons that Guatemala is just easier access? Or
actually, Guatemala is that would be the one you'd think would not be found if you've actually been to this place. And it's unbelievable. It's exactly like it was found in the 1800s, early 1800s, this main site. Very difficult to get into. You take these little, you have to drive for about 6 hours and over horrible roads, which I'm using the term road rather loosely here. And then you have to take a 6 hour boat ride, and these boats are very narrow, and they can hold about six people. When you get gear in it, it's very tight. You have to go up and down rapids. It's quite dangerous. The site itself, there's no water there. We had to drink river water, and the river's horribly polluted. We saw a lot of dead animals in it, and the things we got in our video was a, there's a lot of whirlpools in this river, and right across from where we were staying, was a rather large whirlpool, and we watched an entire day as a dead horse spun around in this whirlpool, and then on the video, we show, we just move the camera down a little, and you can see the guys on the boat pumping the river water out for us to drink.
Great.
It is unbelievably hot and humid, and there are bugs. Even a Guatemalan archaeologist who we became pretty good friends with is only 28. And he was saying he's too old to do this. It's just so rugged, and running up and down this major, it's a mountain, which was simply covered with pyramid. The entire mountain is the complex. And it's so massive, and there's so many levels. There's levels inside of the current pyramids. There's a pyramid built over a pyramid, built over a pyramid, built over a pyramid. And under those are tunnels, but there's not just one pyramid. The whole thing was a site, solid structures. And it's covered with jungle, and it's in disarray. We think we know where the places are now. We did decide on one spot in particular, which we thought would be a good one when we went, and as it turned out, it does appear to be the spot we need to go. But there's another spot, and so we have a plan which we are floating to the Guatemalan government to do some work there. Their people will do the work, and we'll pay for it.
Well, going back to Egypt, I wanted to mention the 12,500 years again, because I just finished watching. These guys are all give me a dirty
sorry
look
about
now.
That.
No, it's okay. Because I just wanted to get this out, because there was a special I watched not too long ago, and there's actually a book on it also, and you're probably familiar with it too, Greg. A man named Dr. Robert Schock. He is a master geologist. He's a doctor in geology.
That's right, Boston.
Yeah, he's a professor there. And you mentioned Mark Lehner, too, because he's part of this whole thing. Dr. Schock did a lot of work on the Sphinx itself. And I think I discussed it with you guys down here one day. I talked about what I learned from this. And basically, by looking at the erosion on the Sphinx, and also on the rock walls around the Sphinx, he determined that the particular wear on the Sphinx was like these like there was just like caverns going down the side of it. If you look real close, that you can't see from a distance, but if you look real close, there's also wind erosion too. It's like it digs into the rock itself. The rock there, the limestone, the native stone, is layered like a cake kind of, and some of the layers are softer than others. So you'll see the ones that are worn a little farther are the softer layers of rock. Now on the Sphinx itself, you see a lot of what he determines and a lot of his colleagues determine is water damage. Now, as we all know, the Sphinx itself is in the middle of a desert. Now, of course, through using particular computer software, they were able to run the weather patterns back, and what they determined is that the Sphinx itself was built around, well, they're saying it's a huge number. It's probably off by hundreds of years, but around 10,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So the idea we're talking about with Atlantis here kind of fits in with that loosely as far as the time. I mean, broad, big numbers we're not talking about, because as far as the Egyptians are concerned, the SEC and Mark Lehner also, because they had a big debate on this between Dr. Shock and Mark Lehner, saying that, no, the Sphinx was built, I believe Khafre was the one who built the Sphinx.
Yeah.
And it was built around 4,500 years ago when the pyramids were built.
Right.
Nope, we don't want to hear anything more. You're wrong. Goodbye. And that's basically what they said. I mean, they have it on film. You watch these people. You see Dr. Shock trying to discuss this and showing the evidence he has, scientifically proven evidence. And we have nothing. We don't want to talk about it. No. And that's Mark Lehner speaking also. Not that I have a problem with that guy, but it's interesting to hear about this now.
Because now you're suddenly talking about doubling tripling the age of the Sphinx.
Yeah, well, we're also talking about another thing, because everything I'm seeing with what Greg's discussing is tying a lot of this stuff together, like I like to talk about. How is it all interrelated? And we're talking about everything here. We're talking about paranormal activity. We're talking about ancient mysteries. We're talking about lost cities. It's all kind of tying together with this whole idea of Atlantis, possibly. I'll shut up now. I just wanted to get that out.
No,
that's what I was thinking about the whole time he was talking about. The date and time, well, you know, it's supposed to be buried under one of the paws of the Sphinx. And the Sphinx is supposed to only be 4,500 years ago. We're talking about...
You're doubling or tripling the age, or at least tripling the age of the Sphinx.
That coupled with Dr. Shock's evidence of the erosion on the Sphinx, which is rain water damage.
So more or less, it's like they were like, yeah, they're building this the Sphinx, so let's just put this time capsule.
Well, I don't want to say that the Sphinx was built for that purpose alone.
No, I know, but it was more like we could bury it there because it's being built.
Well, they...
Possibly.
Greg, they were told where to put these three things, these three time capsules.
According to Edgar Cayce, they were told... they formulated this plan after this communication... and Cayce said they built the Sphinx, and the date that Graham Hancock and Robert Bouval, and Adrian Gilbert came up with was 10,500 BC, based upon where Orion was in 10,500 BC. That the three stars of Orion were directly over the pyramids, and the pyramids were built to be a representation of Orion's belt, that is, heaven on earth.
Yeah. And that's what I own that book. I have that book at home, and I read that, and it befounded me also, because we're talking about broad dates again.
Right.
And the Egyptians want to stick with it. Well, they want to stick with the fact that the Egyptians built the pyramids. They designed them, and they built them themselves, and they're 4,500 years ago. Leave us alone. Shut up. Go away.
Well, the Sphinx is an enigma, and that I don't mean that as a silly statement, because it's always been called that. But nobody really knows when it was built.
Yeah.
Egyptians assume... by mainstream Egyptology, they assume it was built around 2500 BC or so, at the same time Khafre's pyramid was built. But they don't know. They really do not know.
How
and you're right. Shock actually is going to speak at the ARE this October at a conference.
Ooh, Where's it at?
It's in Virginia Beach. Actually, I'll be there speaking, too, and give an update on all this Atlantis search, the physical search.
I really want to meet that man.
Shock actually believes that the date is not 10,000 years ago. It's a little older, but...
Yeah, I know they talked about it. He said roughly 10,000 years ago, and of course, he was like, these are loose numbers, but still, the point is... Come on, look at this. This is water damage.
Shock cannot associate himself with the Cayce dates and those of Bouval and Hancock.
Oh, of course not. But I'm just seeing a correlation here. That's the only reason I brought it up.
Now, I have seen that Sphinx enclosure, and you're absolutely correct. The erosion is phenomenal. And there's what's interesting is that nothing else there has the same erosion pattern. It's just around the Sphinx.
Exactly.
And the
walls around the Sphinx, too. They show the walls also, the enclosure itself.
Right.
Those are affected, too.
Right. The Sphinx enclosure is a large area around
it.
The Sphinx temple is right in front of it.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the temple's existence is why they cannot just go straight down into where they know a chamber is.
Mm-hmm.
A chamber has been confirmed under the right paw of the Sphinx. Mm-hmm. Zahi Hawass calls it a natural crevice.
It's perfectly square, though, from what I understand.
But it makes a 90-degree turn.
Yeah. Yeah, I read that also. I'm like, okay, that makes a whole lot of sense there, too.
Well, right now, the Egyptian government has a university from England called Birmingham University doing ground-penetrating radar, and their purpose is to map all of the subterranean tunnels that are between the Sphinx and the pyramids. And their actual progress they're not talking about right now, but it's the same university that found a number of tunnels at Saqqara last year. So they are making progress on it.
Well, that's just, I am going to have to go and meet Dr. Schottman.
But I do not think that in any time soon that we're going to hear that they go down into a tunnel under the Sphinx and find anything. I don't think that will happen. I don't think it'll publicly occur.
I was going to say, am I going to sound like a paranoid here?
Well, I met Zahi a number of years ago. Actually, it was at the ARE. He spoke at the ARE.
You've actually met him?
Yes, I did.
Explained
a number of things. You have to put yourself in his position to really understand what's going on.
Yeah.
Egypt is a Muslim country, and Egypt has no oil. Egypt's entire economy is based upon tourism. Most people don't know that. But then Egypt has tourists coming from all over the world, and a lot of people have all of these ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are quite anti-Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
They have there's an underlying political problem here, so Zahi has to walk a very careful line. The other thing is, Zahi has a lot of people accusing him of things. He explained how he had people trying to break into his house because these people believed a rumor, which had been spread on the internet, that Zahi had built a tunnel from his house in Giza, or Cairo, to Giza, up into the Hall of Records.
Mm-hmm. I actually heard that rumor.
In his bathroom.
I've actually have a few Photoshop pictures at home that I just found on the internet that have him popping out of his toilet.
That people thought it was in his bathroom, and he had people harassing him about it. And while, you know, that's out there.
Aside from my personal beliefs, I mean, I do respect the man, and I know the pressure he's under to deal with all. I mean, he's basically in the worst middle management position on the planet. He's got to deal with everyone around him, and they all want something,
and they all take shots at him.
And I don't think anything. Oh, yeah. I don't think anything is more anti-Muslim than saying that these beautiful pyramids that were built to worship our God or worship our Pharaoh were built by aliens.
Yeah,
right. That's going to be quite offensive.
Quite anti-Muslim, right there. Right.
Well, you know, the rumor that really it was. You know, for years they thought that Jewish slaves had built the pyramids. That's what a lot of people said, and when you mentioned Jewish slaves did all this great work, it seemed to take something from the Arabs. But in truth, whoever was there at the time built the pyramids. They were probably built far earlier than what they say, although the pyramids weren't built in 10,000 BC. We know that from the carbon dating.
Yeah.
The ARE did. But the Sphinx is another story entirely.
Mm.
And it was built to enclose this record hall, according to Casey, and it was built in 10,500 BC.
You're saying it was built for that purpose, then?
That's correct. And
that's what Casey says.
Okay,
yeah.
All right.
It was oriented to a certain direction. And it was aligned with Orion's belt for a very specific reason, and it's a major message, and it tells people here is where it's buried. In fact, if you go over there and you walk right down between the two paws and you look at a large monument stuck right between the two paws, what you will see is the Sphinx, a carving of the Sphinx, sitting atop a multi-leveled chamber, and that is noticed by almost nobody, but it's a gigantic carving. So it shows the Sphinx actually sitting on these chambers.
Mm.
You can get on the internet and look up Sphinx, look at pictures of the Sphinx, and if you look enough, and probably one out of every five pictures that's a close-up will show you that.
This is directly between the paws, you say?
Right between the paws, right up against the Sphinx's chest.
Mm. I'm slating this conversation one way completely.
Egypt, yeah.
I apologize because of my bias towards Egypt. So, but we can move on if you guys want. But
well, what my question is, what's the political ramifications of Guatemala then? Are they? I mean, do they have? Because I really think that the Egyptian government they've got a lot to protect.
Yeah, they do.
So they've got a lot of a lot of issues over there.
They have an impossible situation. Mubarak, there have been assassination attempts on Mubarak. Sadat was assassinated, and frankly, there are Islamic extremists who want to shut the entire world out of there, and if they have their way, they'll do it. But Guatemala, there is no political situation. It is a very poor third world country.
And that'd be a great thing for them.
Absolutely.
It'd be a wonderful thing for them.
Yes.
Let's talk about tourism right now. That would be tourism right
there. But when you have, do they have, does Guatemala have the other things that you think of when you think of the third world countries like that? Do they have the drug issues and drug czars and things like that, or
there's the movement of some drugs through Guatemala. The main problem they have is the movement of people from Central America up the Usumacinta River into Mexico to enter in America. That's the major route for illegals coming into America. It is the Usumacinta River. From everyone from Guatemala on down, and there are many, many people coming into America from Central America and South America.
Ever since you brought up the Guatemala
thing, I'm sorry?
Ever since you brought up the Guatemala thing and the pyramids, I had a visual of Scott L. going there with a weed whacker.
I have a feeling he just might do that.
And getting all those vines in the jungle off of the pyramids.
He's going to go there and single-handedly uncover that pyramid.
Well, the only problem is that within a couple of weeks, it all grows back, and it grows back worse.
Oh.
It is unbelievable. You have to basically get every remnant of soil away and take everything out and have it just stone, or else it grows back. But what those people use, even people mow their lawns with it, if I can use that term, they use machetes, and it's amazing to watch people bend over at a nice at a nice lawn, and you realize they are mowing their lawn with a machete, and they are cutting it as well as I can mow my lawn with a gas powered lawnmower.
Mm-hmm.
So it's phenomenal.
So Scott's gonna head out there.
Yeah,
with
he'll
a
be
weed
there
whacker.
Next time you see him. Is
and with some weed killer, yeah.
So so there's these records. We're all excited about these, and they may or may not be uncovered soon. The actual location of Atlantis, then, obviously the records are going to be like really important to get to.
Right.
Then why do we have to know where Atlantis was?
Well, we don't, but it is still part and parcel of kind of the bigger picture. I'm not just interested in those records. Frankly, I'm interested in seeing if, or proving whether or not Atlantis existed, and there is only one way to do it. The reason I'm interested in it is because I think there's a huge piece of human history.
Missing.
A big piece of our origin that is missing.
Exactly.
And that's what I would like to find. And the only way we can prove Atlantis existed is to find what Plato described as the center city. And if that is actually found, then mainstream archaeology will take a definite interest. Whether it's American archaeologists or not, it's not important. But mainstream archaeologists will get involved, and we will quickly find out more, because they will then pour their resources, their limited resources, into trying to figure out exactly what Atlantis was, when it existed, and give us a lot more information. The records, to me, are important, but Casey said that even when the records are found, it would take years before anybody would be able to make sense out of them.
Well, yeah, that's the thing right there. We find the records. Can we read them?
Yeah.
That's the big problem right
there. Without a Rosetta Stone for Atlanteans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's all pictures.
Yeah.
Well, that's what the hieroglyphics were for the longest time, but we didn't know how to read them.
Well, you know, it's only been in recent years that they have refined our reading of Mayan hieroglyphics. Casey said that the Atlanteans were a mixture of what looked like Egyptian and Central American hieroglyphics and other different types and styles. So who knows what it's going to look like.
That's going to be amazing. That's going to be one of the things, because
hopefully it happens in our lifetime. That's all. I mean, right there.
I would be like so excited if it
absolutely
did.
I mean, if we found out about it.
How many excursions do you guys go on? Because you went to Bimini
we went to Bimini I think 3 times last year. And Bimini, we have done, and I think the organization has done, just about everything at Bimini that needs to be done. And anything else that we do at Bimini is going to cost a great deal and not yield a lot of evidence. For example, Casey said that Hall of Records is under the slime of ages. And it's in somewhere in the Gulf Stream. It's very deep there, 300 feet or so. and we need to use a technology called sub-bottom profiling. We have used side-scanning sonar for decades, which gives you the actual contours of the bottom. But sub-bottom profiling looks through the sand and silt and even layers of the stone to let you see what's there. But it's a very slow and tedious process and extremely costly because you have to use a research boat to do it, and it's going to take months. On the other hand, at Andros, we were able to fly around it. It cost quite a bit to do this. We did the first aerial survey of Andros. Now, just to give you a perspective of where these islands are, Bimini is 50 miles due east of Fort Lauderdale or Miami.
Okay.
Miles. And it is the closest of the Bahama Islands. Then, if you fly another 100 miles east, you come to the northern part of Andros. Andros is the largest of the Bahama Islands. And if you go another 50 miles east, you hit Nassau, which is on New Providence Island. Most people go to Nassau. Nobody goes to Andros. Andros is 104 miles long. It is an odd-shaped island. Looks a lot like South America in shape. It's about 40 miles wide at its widest. It's made up of thousands of islands. There's no fresh water on the surface, but there's huge amounts of fresh water under the surface. It sits on a huge limestone outcrop, and it is encircled by, on one side, very shallow water. In fact, in western Andros, you can walk 10 miles into the ocean, and you're never over your head. The water's never over your head. It's amazing. There's also mud on the other side. I'm calling it mud, but it's like putty. It's pure white. In one scene from a video, from a documentary we did last year, I'm standing in this stuff. I'm in water that's only ankle deep, but the water comes up to my waist because that's how deep I had sank into this white mud.
Yeah.
And I did get out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. With a crane and.
I was hanging on to the boat at the time. We were trying to get the boat into shore, because we were dragging bottom at the time. And we never did find bottom. We had a long pole, which we stuck about 8 feet into the mud and never found the bottom. So we don't really know how deep it is there. We looked at a lot of circles that we saw from the air, a particular circle that looked like a stone circle from the air that was first seen in 1968 was what we wanted to get to, and we did get to it. We were hoping that it was, in fact, a megalithic stone circle. As it turned out, it was a circle of sponge.
Oh, and that's the photo that's in your book, right? That the aircraft pilot took.
Yeah, that's one. And then later in the book, you can see our photo of the same formation from the air. We took a lot of video of it, and then we reached this thing on the water. It was very difficult to get to. We had to pay a lot of money to get anybody to take us. Nobody would take us. It's too dangerous. You can't fly over, and large boats can't go, and no one with like a sport boat could go because it's so shallow. You got to go 40 miles through water, which is sometimes only 4 or 5 inches deep. So we got a sponge diver to take us over, and that turned out really well. We had the GPS that we got from the aerial survey. We found all the circles. Everything was natural. Then we went, the next time we went to Andros, we went to a place called Rebikoff's E, named after a French oceanographer by the name of Dmitri Rebikoff, who saw this E-shaped formation in 1969. They were certain it was man-made. We got to it the second time we went to Andros and found that it, too, was natural, as all those were.
I hate to do this because this is going to open a can of worms again. Another of our favorite topics, or my favorite topics, I should say, that you actually make fun of in your book is the Philadelphia experiment.
Did I make fun of that?
Yes, you did.
and what?
Here's where.
Is that in the Atlantis book?
Yes.
Really?
You were talking about Rebikoff. And it turns out the fellow who wrote the case for UFOs.
Morris K. Jessup.
Jessup. You said that Jessup was on his way to Rebikoff's house.
Well, it was actually Valentine's house.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. But Valentine and Rebikoff are correlated somehow.
That's right. They were good buddies. They all lived together down there. And some of them are still there.
Okay.
People still live in the same place.
Jessup was on his way to Valentine's house, who was a friend or associate of Rutherford.
A very close friend of Valentine, yes.
And, of course, everybody here on Ghostly Talk knows what happened to Jessup.
Mm-hmm.
He allegedly committed suicide, which I don't know if he committed suicide or not, but he allegedly did.
But all his records were out of the car when they found him, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm aware of all that.
Yeah, much like, so, but I thought that was really interesting, but you did call the Philadelphia experiment a little out of the ordinary.
Well, if you know the details of the Allendale, the guy who Jessup talked to, and, well, actually Allendale he did talk to, but it was after Allendale annotated a book and the Navy got a hold of it.
Yep.
If you know what the Navy was actually doing at the time, and they did pull the ships into the Philadelphia Navy Yard. My father and uncle were in the Navy at the time, and what the Navy actually did, they did actually put these gigantic cables, electrical cables, and run them around ships, and they were mainly minesweepers that they did it to.
Right, in order to degauss the ship.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Basically demagnetize them. That's it. So they would not set off
radar
mines.
They were invisible radar.
And these things, and they had to get away from this. It was actually quite dangerous. But the Philadelphia experiment, the idea has been around a long time, and my first area in all this was UFOs, and of course that whole thing is intricately involved in the UFO field.
Mm. Oh yeah, but there's also a lot of other interesting stuff associated with the Philadelphia experiment that we've studied.
Sure.
And that goes into things like time travel and stuff like that. So it gets a little bit.
Right.
It does get a very very difficult to wrap your mind around a lot of this stuff. But once you take it all in and let it jangle around in your brain for a while,
you go insane.
Yeah, after you go insane, you do get like little lines start drawing themselves as pieces to the puzzle, the big puzzle of just what is going on in this world. And there's a lot of it.
That episode is in that book, not because we were making fun of the Philadelphia experiment. It's a little human interest story to J. Manson Valentine, the man who discovered the Bimini Road. And Valentine knew Jessup so well. All those guys lived, and it's funny that in that era, all those fellows were living right in the area of Coral Gables, within a very short drive of each other. And Valentine was a professional. I mean, he was a consummate professional.
Mm-hmm.
He believed in it. Valentine believed till the day he died in the Philadelphia experiment. He believed there was something there, but Jessup was going to come over and tell him the entire story. Jessup had just come back from a meeting with the U.S. Navy in Washington.
Right.
But Valentine never got to hear the whole story, and I thought that was just a little interesting human interest story.
Well, it actually really piqued my interest because we talk a lot, or we, not a lot, but we talked once, I guess, with
Bill Nell,
who's a reporter and author out of New York City. And he goes into the Montauk thing where they were experimenting with energy and mind control and all of Tesla's ideas,
right.
Nikola Tesla. That was all around the same time as and tied to, in many ways, the Philadelphia experiment. And
I do know they were trying to make invisible ships invisible to radar. I do know that.
They've even said that would have been a wonderful boon to the Navy.
Right. Now we do have ships that are invisible to radar.
Yeah, now we have them, so there
we
you go. but yeah, I thought that was really cool. So Bimini Road and Cuba, how come those are important?
Well, the Bimini Road was found. Actually, Valentine is the one credited with it in '68. He was everybody believes verified one of Casey's predictions. In 1940, Casey said that a portion of Atlantis would be found in 1968 and 1969 near Bimini, and he said that in '40 again. So in '68, that is when the first discovery was at Andros. Then in late '68, Valentine found what is called the Bimini Road. Geologists, a few, have said that it is natural beach rock. I agree that it's beach rock, but that doesn't mean anything, per se. Limestone is beach rock. Most people don't know that either, and the Great Pyramid is mainly built of limestone.
Exactly.
But the Bimini Road was thought to be some sort of remnant of Atlantis when it was found, and both Dmitry Rebikov and Valentine asserted that it was beach rock, and they were the first ones to say it was. And then they said that they thought that it might be a breakwater enclosing a harbor. Rybakov had been to the Mediterranean, and at that time they were just beginning to work around the Mediterranean on what are known as Phoenician harbors. And there are hundreds now of Phoenician harbors that have been found throughout the Mediterranean, and they're very, very similar to the Bimini Road. And all of them are made from beach rock. And that's what led us to Andros. We found a similar structure at Andros, but much better covered and in much better condition. It goes against all the geologists' arguments that they put forth when they tried to debunk the Bimini Road, and it's the exact opposite of everything they say. We think it's made of beach rock, but we're not sure, at Andros, and it looks like a breakwater. It gets higher as you go into the ocean, very flat stones, very square and rectangular, tight seams and so on, and there's an area near it which apparently has paving stones on this flat bottom.
And there's a picture of that in your book as well.
Yes. In fact, that's one of the reasons we went to National Geographic a few months ago. We really wanted to investigate the paving stones, as well as what we initially identified as impossible tool marks. Since then, we found more of these tool marks, and a fellow from the University of Leiden, which is in the Netherlands, it's the computer expert for the physics department at the University of Leiden, has done an analysis on Andros, and he actually was the one who found more tool marks on our video, and then he found similar tool marks at sites all over Peru. And Andrew Collins, who was here last week, found and showed us photos of the exact same tool marks at a variety of ancient sites as far away as Turkey. And they're not natural. These are square indentations. Andrew used a term for them that I cannot remember. But they're marked. They are square indentations that were used to move these blocks. They would insert something into the squares. But we found about five of those now in the Andros platform, although the book only describes one.
Mm-hmm. Well, how come I was under the impression, now I read the book rather quickly, but I'm wondering, how come that was related to Cuba?
Okay, here's where Cuba comes. That's a good question. In fact, Casey talked about the best way to find ruins and remnants of Atlantis was to follow the Gulf Stream, go to the Gulf Stream, and then go to the south and to the west. And if you do that, you wind up at Cuba. Now, back in the year 2000, a British author who's quite well known, Andrew Collins, wrote a book called Gateway to Atlantis, and that is the first time that I ever saw the idea that Cuba could have been the main island of Atlantis. And he followed Plato's statement that Atlantis was an island empire. Plato said that by hopping from one island to another, you'd reach the opposite continent. And Edgar Casey said that in 28,000 BC, Atlantis was basically five large islands, and that the island of Poseidia was Bimini and Andros combined, but there were other main islands. There were four others. Nobody asked him where they were, so he didn't say. So anyway, Andrew Collins wrote this book. I met Andrew. I got Andrew to speak at the ARE a few years ago and met him. While we were there at the ARE, we went into this library called the Sykes Library, and there was a fellow who was a British ambassador for many years by the name of Edward Sykes. Sykes traveled the world for 80 years, accumulating everything written about Atlantis from newspapers, books, magazines in every language. So this room is stuffed with books and huge files of articles, and I mean, it's just stuffed with them. We spent hours going through there and found several original magazine articles in Spanish from Cuba and from other Spanish publications, which zeroed in on a specific area of Cuba as Atlantis. And all these were written before Castro. They were written in the 50s. And when Castro came into power, all of these researchers, we don't know what happened to them, but they've never been heard from again, at least professionally. We don't really know, like I say. But that was one clue, which Collins had written in his book, know. He had read someone else's report that Cuban archaeologists had found some clues that a part of Cuba was related to Atlantis, but nobody knew what it was. So anyway, Collins wrote this book in the year 2000. Then in the year 2002, a group called ADC, Advanced Digital Communications, out of Canada, was doing work for the Cuban government on a ship called Ulysses. They were basically steaming around Cuba using side-scanning sonar and magnetometers to try to find treasure. It's believed that there's about $1 trillion worth of Spanish gold, galleons, sunk all around Cuba, and the Cuban government is desperate for money. So they employed this company to try and find the galleons. On the extreme southwest tip of Cuba, the water gets extremely deep. That's called the Yucatan Channel. And the depth of the water right offshore is 2,100 feet.
Wow.
And at 2,100 feet, their side-scanning sonar showed what looks like, in this flat area on the bottom, it's like a flat sandy plain, they found what looked like a one and a half square mile area of buildings, stone buildings, including what they describe as pyramids, multi-tiered structures, and so on, done in a very uniform pattern. They subsequently dropped a remote camera. It wasn't a very good one. They didn't have a good one at the time. And they got some very poor quality photos of it and digital images. It's just not very high quality. Andrew Collins has seen it all. I've seen some of it. And actually, on this special, the National Geographic airs in November or December of this year, is supposed to show it all because they went to Cuba after they were done with us. But Cuba fits in it because we believe that a particular area of Cuba, not this area off of southwest Cuba, but another area, is where we'll find Plato's center city, because on satellite imagery we obtained, we found an area which precisely fits Plato's descriptions, including all these man-made canals to the north, which lead to a circular mountain, or like a semicircle of a mountain protecting this area. So you have man-made canals moving up to this semicircular mountain, and at the base of the mountain there's a river which then flows into the ocean on both sides. So that area is where we think it may very well be the center city of Atlantis. You can actually see an underwater island, and when I say that, I mean it was an island during the last ice age, because the waters were a lot lower, but today it's a massive swamp area. So as soon as we can go to Cuba legally and get an expedition together, which we're basically prepared now, it's just the legal situation is insane, we're going to go to this area. And it's in the Zapata Peninsula, and it is. There's lots of images on the ARES website of it, and there's a very poor quality black and white one in the book, but there's no way to really show the different colors showing the contours and the rings around this island.
See, that's all. You would think that, like, the entire world, the entire free and communist world, would be, like, petitioning Cuba to allow researchers in there for that. I can't see it doing anything but benefiting Cuba.
Well, Cuba will allow people to come in and spend money. The problem right now is the American government will not. That's the problem. We have to, you can go there illegally. It's quite easy. The penalties have increased and the scrutiny of American travelers has increased a lot in the past months. But right now the situation is probably worse than it's been, at least since the Cubans shot down planes, which, by the way, extreme south southern Andros is in Cuban airspace, and we flew all around there because southwestern Andros is where we found the main circle that we were looking for. So we flew into Cuban airspace, but we flew very, very low at 500 feet and actually very, very slow.
Well, I don't blame you. not that you know that they're shooting planes down and stuff.
Well, they haven't done that in a few years.
But it's dangerous to go around there and not at least let them know what's going on. So yeah, that's kind of scary. When how much danger is there to go to Guatemala?
It is number one. I don't know whether I should say this or not. We took in terms of health. We actually carry a drug called Cipro with us. Cipro is a very strong antibiotic. In fact, it's the one you take if you get anthrax. We actually took Cipro as a prophylactic, and which means we took it, not prophylactic, but prophylactic. We took that to ensure that we would not get sick. And in fact, we never got sick even drinking that polluted water. So that's one thing. If we had not taken that drug, we would have gotten sick. Then we would have had to have taken it anyway, but it would have ruined everything. And when you're at Piedras Negras, there's no way to get out but reverse the process of getting on a boat, and then you go upriver for 8 hours over these, and you have to get out of the boat and move across stones because of the rapids in some places, and then you'd have to get a car to drive 6 hours to Flores. That's the closest place where they might have a hospital. So you basically can't get sick. You're in trouble if you do, or you've got to carry whatever you're going to need. As far as other dangers go, in Guatemala City, which is really large, if you ever go there, there are some areas that are considered safe, but everywhere we went in Guatemala City, we saw people outside and standing at every store, no matter what kind of store it was, in every hotel, and actually every driveway, and they had shotguns. And they had shotgun shells going down, like making an X over their chest. And they're just all, everybody's armed there. Everybody employs private security. There's been a lot of kidnappings of tourists, particularly American tourists. But outside of Guatemala City, when you go to Tikal, which is the big site there, which is fairly well preserved, and say Flores, you're safe. But in Guatemala City and some of the highlands, it's not recommended people go, and if you go, you have to be very cautious. So we were cautious, but in truth, we were not in control of what went on. The only thing we controlled was whether or not we'd take Cipro to not get physically ill. But we never felt in any danger, except in Guatemala City. And then a few times, actually we did something stupid. The guy, one of the Guatemalans, we employed 7 people to take us, and that was barely enough. Obviously, to get there, you need to go with a large group, or you have to hire a lot of people to get you in and take care of things. Because 2 people did nothing more than use machetes to hack our way through the jungle around different areas of the site.
Wow.
And they were Guatemalans who had been to the site many times. In fact, they were former Guatemalan guerrillas who are now employed by the government.
So let's speculate a little bit.
Yeah.
Why are the records hidden in, or not hidden, but why are they put in such inaccessible places?
Well, I can tell you what Casey said, and then I can compare it to what we've come up with. Casey said they were put in places where they could not be found by the wrong people. It would take an intentional effort by someone when consciousness was at a certain point and people had more pure motivations for it, that they would be accessible. But before then, they would not be accessible. They simply just could not be found by going and looking for them. And he said that when the time was right, they'd be found. Now, Piedras Negras, for example, there hasn't been any looting there, but and it's an incredible site. But if you go to any other Guatemalan ruins that are outside of that little area, everything's been looted. So it is so inaccessible, it is so difficult to get to, that only in recent years are archaeologists going. They go in once a year and they spend about 3 weeks there. That's it. And so they can only look at a tiny little area in those 3 weeks, but it hasn't been looted again. So if you were going to hide something and you didn't want looters to find it, or you didn't want people to find it who wouldn't know what they had and maybe destroy it or sell it or lose it, you'd put it in a place like Piedras Negras. But it makes sense from another standpoint. If you were leaving, say, anywhere in the Caribbean or in the Gulf, either the Bahamas or Cuba, and you wanted to find a location to hide something, there's only one river that actually goes anywhere near the Yucatan. The Yucatan itself has no rivers. Most people don't know that, but there's not a single river in the Yucatan. But there is a river which divides, or that cuts across the very top of it, and it's the Usumacinta. And it goes all the way into the highlands of Guatemala. So if you got on a boat there and you went up that river, you would eventually reach this site. site of Piedras Negras, and it would be quite remote so that no casual people would ever find this location. So if you knew you wanted to wait for technology and people who were deliberately wanting to look at this location, that's where you'd put it. And it might take 10 or 12,000 years.
I mean, that's a lot of foreplanning, you know, like...
Well, that's what, you know, that's... I've really gotten into studying this thing about the story about this non-human or extraterrestrial communication to this Atlantean priest. I was startled when I saw it. In fact, I don't know anybody in the ARE who had actually read it and seen it for what it was. When you read it, it's very clear. Before we looked at that, in all these years, these readings have been there, and Edgar Evans Casey, Casey's son, wrote the definitive book on Casey's story of Atlantis, but he didn't even mention it in his. But yes, foresight and planning, but if you were looking down at the Earth and trying to decide where you'd put things, well, at that time, we already know a few things about the ancient Americas. Do you know how many people were here when Columbus got here, approximately?
No.
Not really, no.
Would you want to guess?
You mean on
Americas.
The North Americas. And South America? 20,000 people?
That's a nice guess. That's what most people might guess. According to mainstream archaeology and the most conservative estimates, there were at least 57 million people living in the Americas when Columbus got here.
Wow.
57 million. South America had 30 million alone, and the only reason more people didn't live up north is because it gets cold. South America just doesn't get that cold. Before that, archaeologists have always thought in America that there was nobody here before 9500 BC, and in 1997 that changed, and it's changed even more now. There were many, many people in the Americas as long ago as 50,000 BC. If you go to South American museums, the National Museum of Guatemala, they show you where the so-called first Americans came from and when. They show them coming from the South Pacific in 50,000 B.C. And the so-called Clovis people who came over from across Beringia from Siberian Asia at the end of the Ice Age in 9,500 B.C. were latecomers.
Yeah, there's a lot of controversy over that right now.
Now, the Clovis first theory is basically collapsed. It's caused...
Yeah.
Right. But anyway... Casey talked about these 50,000 B.C. people and that the Americas were settled, but that part of Guatemala was not.
Ah.
Ah.
So if you're looking around and you say, oh, look, here's a remote, desolate place.
That's right. And, of course, the one at Bimini or near Bimini sank, and so that one...
That one's protected by...
Yeah, the waters. And the one in Egypt is just protected by that massive structure somewhere on top of it. And, you know, he has precise instructions about where it is, but some erosion has occurred some distance from it, and it's just proven to be a political nightmare trying to get to it.
So there may be more to coincidence than meets the eye.
Right.
Not just one great, great big coincidence. Speaking of coincidences... We're done with our hour and a half.
I know.
This is it. Oh my gosh, it flew by, Greg. For me, that's all I can say.
For me also.
And I have to say, what book is it that we're talking about? By the way, let people know.
That one is the ARE Search for Atlantis. You can look on Amazon or call the ARE or get on our website. I think you have a link to the ARE's website on your website.
Yep, yes, we do.
People can click through and see it all there and see our other books and the video. There's actually 10 clips of our video you can look at and see a lot of this stuff. It's on QuickTime files on our website.
Well, I don't know, but I will definitely watch the National Geographic special in November or December.
Okay, it's in a new series they're doing, and we're probably going to do another one with them. It's called Naked Science.
Oh, wow.
But we do have our clothes on, so.
Oh, well, you know. I guess it's not that kind of a channel anyway, huh?
Well, actually, they used to be the Geographic,
well,
but now
true.
It's
right, exactly.
But I have to say thank you so much. I don't know if we'll see you at the Mothman festivities coming up at the
hopefully we
in
will
a couple months.
Each other.
Or Scott L's going to drag me down to Virginia Beach, Virginia with him for the ARE conference. We may end up being members and going to that. Scott L is way big on pyramids and Egypt and that kind of stuff. So knowing that,
and John Anthony West will be there. West also studies the all of the pyramids over there. That's his area. He'll be at the conference too.
So who knows? We may end up.
I might end up not coming home.
Yeah, we're just going to move to Virginia Beach, Virginia.
That's happened to a lot of people. So.
But thank you, Dr. Little.
Thank you, Greg.
Your book again. I can't even tell people how fascinating it is. And the little things that tie into everything that we talk about here on Ghostly Talk, like the little Philadelphia experiment connection. I mean, everything. It just engrossed me.
It all seems to tie in.
And it all ties in, and this is an important piece. Atlantis, Dr. Little, the book is The ARE Search for Atlantis. Thank you, Dr. Little.
You're a true adventurer, sir.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure, and I don't know how much longer I'll keep it up, but one of you may take the torch.
I would consider it a pleasure and an honor, sir.
I think he's filling out application forms right now for the ARE. So
put out on a $50 bill.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And
that's the end, man.
That's the end of our show.
We're done.
That's the end.
That was a storytelling safari.
That was awesome.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
Whoop.
I have to say, this has been Ghostly Talk. We do have to make way for W Paranormal, mm-hmm. which is coming up next on Pioneer, pioneer.rolo.net. Our website, of course, is www.ghostlytalk.com. Thank you very much to our special guest, Dr. Gregory Little, who just wrote the book on ARE's Search for Atlantis.
A lot of knowledge there, too. God.
Incredible.
A lot of knowledge.
Incredible.
There.
So go to Amazon.com and buy that sucker, or ARE's website.
We both have a copy of it. I've grazed, but the little time I've had, it's just been like, oh, you know. And
it's amazing.
Those little things he hit, I'm like, oh, my God.
And to have him tie it all together like that was just incredible.
Yeah.
So next up, W Paranormal, I'm Doug.
I'm Scott L.
And I am Karma.
And this has been Ghostly Talk. See you here next Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time.
True science will not deny the existence of things because they cannot be weighed and measured. It will rather lead us to believe that the wonders and subtleties of possible existence surpass all that our mental powers allow us clearly to perceive.
We must ignore no existence whatsoever. We may variously interpret or explain its meaning and origin, but if a phenomenon does exist, it demands some kind of explanation.
A quote from The Principles of Science, William Stanley Jevons, 1835 to 1882.